Welcome to yet another exciting episode of Mkwazi Unfiltered. As you well know, Mkwazi Unfiltered is a podcast that shows you the human side to some of the larger-than-life personalities that we have here in Zambia. We've had some very interesting guests on this podcast up to this date, and today's no exception. We have an individual who's going to literally amaze you with what he has done over his lifetime. It's been a lifetime packed with lots of experience and an uncanny ability to break down very complex topics into simple, bite-sized chunks for the public like you and me. My name is Kamiza, and I'll be hosting an individual who is absolutely incredible. He's a medical doctor, but he's a unique one in that in many cases, we talk to medical doctors and they leave us more confused than understanding because they bring out complex terms and you're left with the head spinning. He's found a way of connecting with the public, and not just his patients, but literally anyone and everyone who has access to social media. He's an individual whose voice has been heard around the country time and time and again, and he's a gentleman who men ascribe to regularly because they always look to listen to the advice that he has for them on men's health topics. To give you a little hint about who we're talking to, at some point he was known as Dr. Watermelon, and he single-handedly caused a shortage of watermelon in the country when men went wild buying it for their own good health and good well-being. He is a man who goes by many names, but the name that he is well-known for is Dr. Aaron Mujajati, and he's our guest today. Welcome to Mkwazi Unfiltered, Dr. Mujajati.
Thank you. And thanks for inviting me. And good to see you.
It's always good to see you. Always good. There are memories we can go back to, but let's... You're looking very well.
Thank you, my brother. Thank you.
It's been a long time, but I have been keeping tabs on what you've been up to.
Right.
Like I said in the intro, Mkwazi Unfiltered is about finding out the person behind the personality. Mm. And so we will start with the origin story that you have to share with us. When were you born? Where were you born? And what type of neighborhood did you grow up in?
Right. I was born right here in Lusaka.
Ah.
I was born at UTH, by the way.
There we go.
I ended up working there as well.
Yes.
So I was born right here in Lusaka. I was born of a Shona man.
Right.
From Zimbabwe. And a Lozi woman from Western Province. What is interesting about my mother is that she was also born and raised in Zimbabwe, Blawayo.
Oh, wow.
So she speaks very good Ndebele. So I was raised by those two. Not very far from here. If you know Lusaka very well, you know Mandevu area, Chaisa
yes.
area.
Yes, yes.
So I was born and raised in Chaisa.
Wow.
But my parents began their life in Western Province.
Right.
Yeah, that's where they were. They met, married, Western Province. They had two children.
Right.
From there, which is my older brother, my older sister. Then they moved to Lusaka.
Right.
That's when I was born.
From here.
Yeah. So my parents, between the two of them, have 10 children, and I'm the third born.
Wow.
Yes, it's a very productive
Extremely. They took it personal to go forth and multiply.
They took God seriously.
Oh, yes. They weren't playing games.
So they have 10 children. I'm the third born of the 10. Yes.
Wow. Now, interesting. And how was your relationship with your siblings growing up?
Like any other home. Mm. You know, when you come from a very big family like I did, you had good times, tough times,
right.
joyful times, not so joyful times.
Right.
We were raised in Chaisa compound, if you know where it is.
Yes.
A very, very tough neighborhood during those days. Mm. Not a very easy neighborhood to raise children, but they managed, surprisingly. Mm. And so the house was always very noisy. It wasn't a very big house. It was a small house, three bedrooms. All the boys in one bedroom, all the girls in one bedroom. Wow. And you had to find where to sleep. Your older brother slept on the bed. The rest of you slept
You
on
figured
the floor.
It out. You made a plan. You had to be creative, right?
If visitors came, you slept in the sitting room or in the kitchen.
Yes.
And if you slept in the sitting room or kitchen and it's time for people to start sweeping, they come and wake you up very early because they have to sweep.
Exactly. Exactly.
But we were also raised by a very tough
father. Mm.
My father was a disciplinarian.
Right.
He did not believe that boys should be asleep by 6 in the morning.
Oof.
And he was of the belief that by the time he wakes up himself,
you should have been awake.
Should have been awake.
Yes.
Not just awake.
But should have done some chores.
Should have been awake doing something.
Yes.
It doesn't matter what it is.
Right.
Find something to do.
Oof.
If he wakes up and he finds that, yes, you are awake, but you're doing nothing. Yeah, he'd actually spank you.
It's an issue.
It was a big issue. It was a big problem in our home. He was like that. Growing up, my dad used to drink and smoke.
Right.
But the way he would beat his children if he found you near a bar, it was, you know.
That's interesting.
That confusion, confusion in values where you drink, you smoke, but if I'm found in such places.
It was quite paradoxical.
The way he would beat you was bad.
Now I guess he said, hey, I'm old enough and I can make my own decisions. You will not do as I do. You will do as I say.
But what's interesting is that later on in his life, he just stopped smoking one day. As difficult as it is to stop smoking for him, he just decided one day, okay, I'm no longer smoking. That brother was a chain smoker.
Wow.
Like where he was, because my dad used to repair his own cars.
Right.
So at home, one of the things we used to do a lot was that this man would strip an engine, and build it up himself, service his own cars. If an engine needed a rework,
he sorted it out.
Engine, take the crankshaft and the engine block for skimming and whatever, bring it back home, and then the sons, you'd be around him making sure that, you know, he finishes. If he had a trip the next day, you're not going to sleep. You'd be repairing that car, trying to fix it up to 3-4 in the morning.
To make sure it's roadworthy.
Yes. And I got to know those old cars with carburetors and stuff.
Oh, yes.
These new ones, I know nothing.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah,
but I was raised around a man like that, a very disciplinarian guy. He also stopped taking alcohol eventually. And surprisingly, we were all shocked that this man has stopped smoking, stopped alcohol.
Just
now, what's his own interesting volition. Is that when we were, you would know that my dad was sitting here by the number of those corks, the taps. That'd be all over the place. You knew he's around.
Oh.
Yeah, you know he was sitting there.
A proper chain smoker.
A proper one. Yeah. And what is interesting about my father is that his children don't drink, his children don't smoke.
I guess the beatings worked.
I don't know.
He did something right. He definitely did something right. Now, if you kept away from what he was so into, then definitely the message was delivered loud and clear.
Yeah.
Stay away from this stuff.
Yeah. So growing up in Chaisa compound, at that time, Chaisa was tough. It was like your current Chibolia, really. It wasn't uncommon. You wake up in the morning, you find a dead body in the street. Somebody was murdered last night.
Yeah.
It wasn't uncommon. You wake up in the morning, you hear the person you were playing with yesterday went out somewhere. They were shot dead by the police.
Oof.
Or they were trying to steal something.
Mm.
We are struggling with the betting thing that you do now.
True.
Those things were very common in Chaisa at that time.
Mm.
Betting was a big issue then.
Right.
Mnachi hapo dies mdare.
They say.
Mnachi hapo trial like.
Courage naga black.
So for us, all those, you know, yenzio beja. Is what I mean. And those things were very common. And the people we played with every day in the night, they were, you know, serious.
Involved. Yeah.
Involved in very heavy things. Going to school and passing an exam was very rare. Failing grade 7 was very commonplace.
Really?
Yeah. And sometimes when I look back, I don't know how they did it. My father's children, all 10 of them finished grade 12 minimum.
No, with the level of discipline you've talked about, no one was messing around in that home.
Surprisingly, all 10 of them finished. But we grew up in a place where failing an exam, failing grade 7 was very common.
That was the norm.
It was the norm. Like among neighbors, we didn't have lawyers, doctors. Mm-mm. We didn't have such things. Mm-mm. We didn't have such people to look up to. Accountants, not even.
Hey. Mm. So from what you're saying, it's clear that your physical location was very different from your mindset location. It's clear that he inculcated a sense of achievement and accomplishment in you and ambition, which was not in at par with the neighborhood that you were in. So
yes.
But were you not treated as oddities then?
No. We played with other kids like anybody else.
Mm.
We played football, we played all kinds of games. We did everything that other kids did in the neighborhood.
Right.
Except that in my father's house, there were things that were not, that you did not compromise.
Mm.
Mm. One of them was going to church.
Uh-huh.
In his house, you had to go to church.
It wasn't an option. I don't feel like
there was no conversation.
You are going to church.
There was no negotiation. Yeah, in my father's house, there was nothing like, no, I don't feel like, no, I can't go to church.
You are going to church. You don't live here anymore.
Brother, that man. So you had to go to church. That was number one. Number two, the other rule in that house that was non-negotiable was school.
Mm.
But interestingly about school, it was my mother who was more pushy about school.
Right.
My father, of course, yes. I mean, he made sure he paid the school fees all the time.
Right.
But in terms of like just pushing, making sure everybody's going, my mother pushed that a lot more.
Mm.
Yeah. So those two things in their home were non-negotiable.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Now, I've heard that at the age of 4, you had a medical emergency and a situation that, a condition that nearly had you lose a leg.
Yes. So when I was very young, between 4 and 5, I had what you call pyomyositis in this leg here.
Right.
So pyomyositis, basically, it's a medical term that means chipute, but in muscle.
Ooh.
Yeah. So chipute cha muscle, meaning that I had an infection affecting the whole leg.
Oh, dear.
So when they would squeeze out the pus, they would make me stand in a dish and start squeezing the pus from here, from up here, and
from
then
the
they're
thigh.
Pushing downwards, yes.
Ooh.
And then the pus would come out like a tap. Yes, it was that bad.
Good Lord.
Yes, of course. Yes. There are pictures of me in hospital that if you looked at in modern times, everyone would have concluded I had HIV AIDS.
Really?
Yes, they were that bad. It was so bad that when I was around 18, 17, thereabout, one of my dad's relatives from Zimbabwe left me in hospital, then came back to visit when I was around 17, 18.
Hmm.
So in talking to my mother, he was like, how many children do you now have? My mother said, okay, this many. And then he asked and said, but you had one child who died.
The one you lost. Oh. Yeah.
So you had one child who died. No, my mother said, no, I had no child who died. So you mean that child I left in the hospital survived?
Oh, wow.
And I said, it's that one there. Yeah, pointing at me.
Wow.
Yeah. It was... looking back, right, when the doctors decided to do an amputation,
right,
it was the correct decision.
Really?
Yes. If with the benefit of hindsight and the fact that I'm a doctor now,
right,
that's the decision I would have made.
Really?
Yes. If I was the adult in the room, I would have insisted they did an amputation as well. So when they made the decision to do an amputation, because I was in the hospital for a very long time.
Oof.
So when they decided to do an amputation, my father correctly consented. He agreed, yes, to do an amputation.
Right.
Yeah. My mother did not agree with the amputation.
Mm. Mm.
So what she did was she told my father, look, me, I don't agree with this amputation business. I've heard the doctors. I've heard everything they have said. There's no way. I'd rather this child dies than lives life with one leg. How is he going to survive?
Wow.
I can imagine the conversation. I was too young. But looking at the results and how things went, right. I can imagine what, and now that I'm a parent, I have my own children, I also right. have a wife.
Right.
I can imagine the type of conversation.
No, those are not easy conversations.
Took place, you see. No. And so, lo and behold, the doctors came in the morning. Parents have given consent to do an amputation.
Right.
And they come in the morning, the patient is not on the bed. My mother had run away from the hospital.
She sprung you out of hospital.
She packed me up nicely and wrapped me up and
pulled a prison break.
She lammered. Yeah, yeah.
Hey!
She ran away from the hospital. And the husband is there, you know, waiting to see the doctors to come and take the child to theater.
Baby, and there's no child there.
There were no cell phones then.
No, no.
And at that time, you know, dad comes home, finds the child home and the wife home with the child who is also very sick. She insisted, I'd rather he's dead. Not those things that you're telling me.
Not my son. My son will not.
So she now started taking care of me from home.
Wow.
Yeah. So now she started draining the pus herself from home.
Mm.
Yeah, yeah. She'd wake up in the morning, drain the pus by herself, drain the pus by herself, until the pus finished.
Wow.
And the wounds healed. If I were to show you my leg, I have all kinds of holes in my leg. I have all kinds of, you know, surgical things. I'm a doctor now. I can see. I know what they were doing. When I was a kid, I didn't know what these things were.
Wow.
So when it finally healed, it healed in flexion like this.
Right, right.
And because it healed in flexion, fixed flexion, so the leg wasn't straight.
Ah, it healed. Okay.
So to move around, I used to move around on my butt.
So you lost the ability to stand.
I forgot how to walk. I used to, you know, move around on my butt around like this in the house. So she kept me in the house for a long time. So what she did, because my mother's young sister was a nurse. I think that's why she was getting some of those ideas.
Right, right.
Because when I look back, one of the things she used to do to me, I saw it in the hospital. It's called skin traction.
Really?
Yes. How she learned how to do skin traction, I don't know. But now looking back, I think because my young sister was a nurse. Maybe that's where she learned it from.
Right.
So they would put me on the bed and then tie bricks.
Right.
And tie my leg to a rope and then drop the... To pull the leg.
Right.
So
right.
That's how I would learn how to thing. So every day she would stretch the leg with warm water and everything.
Right.
Now that was torturous. It was very painful by cooperation. No anesthesia.
No.
What that woman did. She should be arrested.
But you're standing on 2 feet.
She should be arrested.
When a mother is determined.
Yeah, yeah. You know, that was weird. What she used to do was, because she was also a praying person.
Right.
And I hated prayer for that reason.
Mm.
Because I associated praying with pain.
Pain, right.
So every time my mother would start singing a hymn, I knew.
Okay, here comes pain.
And
you're conditioned.
Pray, and literally cry tears, praying. When she was done, she was a different human being.
Mm.
She had no feelings for
me. No empathy.
No sympathy, no nothing. She was just too focused on making sure that she stretches
that leg will stretch.
And it was painful. I used to scream. Mungawajua mkuku mnyumu. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then after she stretches it, she would get to my planga so, and then put them under the leg like that, and then tie.
So she'd use splints?
Splints, yes. Goodness. And then tie na malegin so that the leg stays straight.
Right.
And then she would put me in her trousers, and then she would now start teaching me how to walk all over again in the house. I'd be walking through, holding things like this, until I learned how to walk. But she, from the time I learned how to walk, she continued to put me in a...
Right.
Yeah. And then when she saw I'd learned how to walk, she'd now get me out of the house. No, go play with your friends.
Right.
But always wearing her trousers.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Because of that, I became very self-conscious.
Mm.
I don't wear shorts.
Right.
You'll never find
to think of it, I've never seen you in shorts.
Never find them in shorts.
That explains a lot.
Yes. And I think it's because of psychological trauma.
Mm.
Yeah, for me to wear a short, I have to be very, I get self-aware. I get very, not uncomfortable.
Mm.
It's psychologically painful to wear shorts for me.
Mm.
But sometimes I do it to myself just to beat that feeling.
Yes.
Yeah. Sometimes I say, you know what?
Yeah. No.
Yeah. But I don't wear shorts for that reason.
Wow.
Yeah.
But how so you were unwell for quite an extended period of time.
For a very long time.
How did that affect your academics? Because that's a key component.
It did. So what my mother did was this. She started teaching me from home before I even started going to grade one.
Right.
So before I even went into grade, remember we used to do?
Yes, hand over the head to touch the opposite ear.
Before I went into grade one, I had already known how to write my name.
Right.
I had already known how to do simple arithmetic.
Oh.
I had already known how to read simple words from home. So she had already started teaching.
Right, right.
Yeah. Where she got the idea to do that, I don't know. But yeah. And my mother didn't go very far in school. I think she stopped school in junior secondary.
Hmm.
But where she got those ideas from, I don't know.
She's just gifted, I guess.
I have no idea. I need to interview that woman.
You should. You really should find out where these ideas came from.
By the time I was going into grade one,
the
things, you know, when you're in grade one at that time, that's when you're learning how to write for the first time, learning how to read.
Yes.
I had no such struggles. I had no such issues.
You were already ahead of the curve.
Yes. I was a little genius for a while. until I stopped focusing on
school. I like that. So I was about to ask, did that not make you cocky in class? Now I know this stuff. I already know how to write my name. You chaps are struggling with holding a pencil. I know how to do these things.
I was a little genius for a while because he had already taught me how to do these things.
Mm. Yeah. Then came a brick wall. I made to understand you failed grade 7.
Yes, I did.
What happened?
I think that by the time I got to grade 4, school changed for me. I don't know why.
Okay.
Suddenly, I couldn't read properly.
Mm.
Suddenly, I couldn't do simple arithmetic.
Mm.
I don't know that my focus changed. I don't know what happened. From a little genius, I was suddenly nenzopasa ma number 20.
From number one.
Hey, number 20, shiny.
The graph dipped terribly.
It dipped very badly.
But how did dad take that?
My dad, as long as he went to school, but my mother used to really get affected.
Right.
Like a lot.
Right.
Yeah. I remember one time she came to get my results at school. And don't sama at school.
In public.
Dad, it wasn't nice. And one of my friends was even, friends were making my fun of me.
Public humiliation.
It wasn't funny. So by the time I was attempting my first grade 7 exam, it didn't go very well for me. I failed. But then in the context of the environment where I grew up, it wasn't surprising.
It was great. And obviously the neighborhood, the statement would be, he tried.
Eh?
At least he tried.
So what they did was, my parents found me a place in grade 8 in Western Province.
Right.
So because Western Province at that time, with the marks that I had, I was going to make it to grade 8, but not here in Lusaka.
Right.
So I was scheduled to go to Western Province at a boarding school there. So they bought everything, bought bags, you know, everything that I needed to go to boarding school in Western Province.
Right.
Then my older brother said, wait a minute, give this guy a second chance. I don't think the boarding school you want to send him will be good for him.
Right.
So let him, you know, try again.
Yeah, give it another go.
When I repeated grade 7, I repeated with a vengeance. I started studying deliberately, reading and preparing and studying. By the time I was writing that exam, I scored very good marks. That's how I ended up at Matero Boys.
Yes.
Now, during our time, Matero Boys used to pick the
the creme de la creme, top. Yes.
You know,
yes.
Grade 7 pupils.
Yes.
Yeah. So that's how I ended up at Matero Boys. I remember during that time, less than 20 kids passed grade 7 from my school at that time.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. So I went to Matero Boys. Matero Boys, it was a very competitive school. Remember, you are dealing with kids from different neighborhoods, but right. These are the top kids where they are coming
top
from.
Top performers.
Yeah,
yes.
Top performers.
Yes.
So now, I didn't want to have that experience I had in grade 7 of failing again in grade 9.
Right.
So I came across these four guys. Bonse, Wenzukaku, Kwa George.
Right.
There were four guys. There were four of them. All of them were coming from Kwa George area.
Yes.
Yeah. And these guys, they were surprisingly very good at everything.
Really?
Yeah. Maths, science, what? So what I noticed was, what I later discovered was that these guys, they study ahead.
Ah.
Yeah. They have books that they study ahead. When they are at home, they are always practicing maths.
Right.
And, you know.
Right.
They compete academically.
Right.
So I decided to latch myself to that group. I literally wormed my way in that group.
Wise move.
When I wormed my way in that group, I realized, so these guys, this is what they do.
This is their edge.
This is what. So I joined the conversation.
Right.
I became their friend. And then Zoenda from Chaisa compound, all the way Kwa George Namendo.
To be able Kwendo to hang out. Yes. Yes.
So fast forward, come grade 9, all of us passed very well. The four of us went to Hillcrest. One of the guys from the group went to DK.
DK, right. Yeah. Right.
And again, Hillcrest was, you know, they
yes.
at national level, the
yes.
very best kids.
Yes.
DK, same thing.
Right.
So of these guys, three became engineers. One became an accountant, and I became a doctor.
Wow.
Yes. And all of us chua kumbun.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, from so, high density areas.
And for our Kwa George. So when I look at those four guys, plus myself, that's why my sister and I have been running a community school in Chaisa, where my parents used to live, in the house where we were raised. My sister and I ran a community school there.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. We've been running it for over 14 years now.
Giving back.
Yes.
Giving back.
So that little school has graduated a number of kids. Some of them are lawyers now.
Amazing.
Some of them are, yeah.
Ah, that's...
So I'm one of the things, I'm a passionate believer in, because I have seen what education can do.
Right, right.
I have seen how transformative education can be.
Mm.
Especially for kids who come from low-income areas like where we come from.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
Mdala, you know, without education, I wouldn't be sitting with you.
No.
I'd be somewhere else or dead.
Yeah, very likely dead.
Yeah.
Very likely.
Most likely,
dead.
Maybe.
Ah, it was rough.
So, even these other guys I'm telling you about, the three engineers and the accountant guy, their lives are good.
Yeah.
Yeah. Unfortunately, one of them died of COVID, which is quite sad. But these are people who, without education, their lives would be something different,
right.
Very different.
Correct.
So that's why, for me, when it comes to education and just making sure that kids get a chance, especially kids in low-income areas.
Right.
I know people like to argue that school is kubenga kupereke, go and do business, go and make money. I agree with all that. But education makes a huge difference for us who come from low-income areas.
It's a great equalizer.
A major. Yeah.
No. So, at which point did the allure of medicine grab hold of you?
Right. So, for me, for the longest time, I always wanted to be a lawyer.
Nantota, is it? It would have worked.
So, I don't know whether you remember, on ZNBC, there used to be a show called Crown Court.
Yes.
When we were kids.
Yes.
Yeah. So I had grown so fond of that show.
That was an amazing show.
That whenever that show came, if I was sleeping, my dad would send someone to wake me up.
His show is on.
Can you go and wake
yes. up? Yes.
Because at that point, you know, I had started communicating that I really want to be a lawyer.
Right.
And so everybody knew I wanted to be a lawyer.
Hmm.
But I didn't know any lawyers in my life.
Right.
No.
Right. Where will you find someone to inspire you?
I never met a lawyer in my life, not even one. But Crown Court would give me a glimpse into what a lawyer looks like and what he does.
Right.
Then when I went to Hillcrest, that was the conversation around me. And my friends knew, those who were very close to me.
This guy wants to be law.
And so when we were now applying to go to UNSA, during my time, we were applying to go to UNSA in the second term.
Right.
Yeah, of grade 12.
Right.
So you'd sit with the careers master, they'll bring the application forms from UNSA.
Right.
Then you write your preferences.
Right.
So you were always writing three.
Three. Options. Yes. Yes.
Now, there was this teacher from Uganda. He used to teach us biology.
Mm.
So he was also the careers master at that time. I don't know that people still have careers masters in this.
I don't know if they still exist. They call them counselors or something. But
they call them counselors.
I think so.
So when that man, when we were filling on these things, so he called me to his office. He's like, so what's your plan? So I told him, I want to be a lawyer. So he looked at me, he's like, you know what? I've analyzed your results and your performance over the years. You are excellent with science and mathematics.
Yes.
Because for me, maths was like a talent.
Right.
I didn't struggle with that subject.
It just made sense.
I could study maths in a bar with so much noise, and I'd be okay.
It still made sense.
Yeah. Right. But other subjects, I can't study in a noisy place.
No.
But maths came naturally to me.
Right.
Yeah. It was a very easy thing to do for me.
Wow.
And science also. Mm. So he told me, look, and at that time I was taking pure sciences plus additional maths.
Right.
So I took ordinary maths, additional maths, and pure sciences.
Wow.
So it was like, if you want to say, if you kind of call humanities, if
you don't need this.
Yeah.
There's no use.
Yeah.
Calculus out the window.
So and then because you're also physically challenged, I wouldn't want you to do engineering. Because for him, it's like engineering is carrying heavy things.
Yes.
I learned later on that engineers don't carry any.
No.
They just carry the
It's heavy lifting, heavy lifting.
So he tells me, why don't you consider doing medicine? And that was the first time I was hearing about medicine. I didn't know that. The doctors I remember is the people who were treating me when I was at UTH.
The pain, yeah.
And then I was afraid of health workers. I had a phobia for nurses and doctors.
No, with the pain you went through, obviously.
If I saw a nurse coming this way, I'd change.
Trauma.
And then
why are you taking me there?
I was listening. But he managed to convince me. So when we were applying, I applied to natural sciences to do medicine.
Right.
And second choice, I wrote the same thing. Third choice, I wrote the same thing. I didn't write like this, that.
And then a different field. No,
I wrote the same thing.
It's all this or nothing.
I wrote the same thing.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. I was silly like that. So,
or confident?
No, I was just being silly, man. I was just being silly. So when that, because the acceptance letters used to come through the mail.
Yeah.
So when the acceptance letter came through the mailbox, I was accepted in natural sciences. That's how I went into natural sciences, and because I enjoyed science,
right?
I didn't struggle that much with my first year at UNSA. Second year, I didn't have any issues. I only started having issues when I went to medical school proper in third,
right,
going upwards.
Right.
Yeah, that's when they brought us to size.
Yes. They reminded you of your mortality.
From mucha ma A, na ma A plus, na ma B plus, kuja, muka chaka C, so.
Scraping through, like, whew. It's a sigh of relief.
No, we were brought to size. We were
humbled.
We were humbled. Because, you see, when we went into medical school at that time, we were 800 candidates at UNSA vying for 50 slots in medical school.
Wow.
Yes.
So 750 are disappearing.
They picked 50 that went to medical school. When we went to medical school, out of that 50, the original 50, only 27 made it to the end.
Wow.
Tenze kuferu uka ima
kumita. Hey.
UNSA. I hope things have changed. They transformed us, those people.
It was a brutal environment.
We became anti-social, anti-everything. Because
you didn't have time for anything else, did you?
This place. Medical school at that time, they would fail you for a bad haircut.
Really?
Oh, yeah. They would fail you for not dressing properly. So sometimes I get surprised when I see these young doctors nowadays with a funny haircut, not dressed
Not in our time.
No.
Things have changed. But what lessons did you glean from university? Because we've obviously learned how tough it was in primary and secondary and how you adapted and adjusted. What lessons were your takeaway from your university days?
And I'm saying this with the benefit of hindsight.
Right.
I don't think I saw it while I was going through it.
Mm.
The biggest thing I learned, if it's just one, was the value of discipline.
Right.
Yes.
Right.
We had very intelligent people. We had very talented people whose lives went differently because of lack of discipline. Or whose lives could have gone differently had they not been disciplined. Even myself, my circumstances could have been very different had it not been for discipline. And when I look back, I had no problems with discipline because of the kind of household I came from.
Correct.
Yes, I was raised by
a semi-military man.
Semi-military man. Yes, no-nonsense guy. Yeah, there were no jokes there.
Ooh.
Yeah. And I was raised by a father who did not entertain excuses, who did not entertain complaining. Yeah.
Just get it done.
No, get it done. Yeah.
I don't have time for your stories.
You can cry, wait for you finish crying. When you're done, you will still get it
done. Get it done. Yeah.
So why are you wasting time crying? You might as well just do it.
You were in a furnace. You didn't realize you were in a furnace.
I was.
So
we were panel beaten. Oof. So when I went to medical school, discipline and everything, because of the environment I grew in. And I'm saying this with the benefit of hindsight, right?
Right, right.
Yes. Discipline was key.
I hear you. And so, carrying over from university days, now you've graduated, you're a medical doctor. There's that gap before placement. How did you survive those days? Because you've got a qualification now, but you don't have a job.
I see. So our circumstances were very different.
Mm.
We didn't go through what these graduates are going through now.
Right.
Zambia used to produce very few doctors.
Mm.
And it was extremely competitive to get into medical school.
Right.
And even if you went into medical school,
it
was extremely competitive to stay in medical school. Remember, out of 800 people that wanted to get into medical school, only 50 made it.
Right.
Yeah. And then out of the 50 that made it, in my original class, only 27 made it to the end. Yes. So now, Zambia used to produce very few doctors.
Mm.
And because Zambia used to produce very few doctors, as we were employed
immediately
while in medical school.
Oh, wow.
So what used to happen was this. When we graduated, the minds would come and pick up the doctors that they had already selected while we were in school. So they would send very nice cars from the mines. Kubutenga magaiz wabatenga.
Hey.
Nanchito ayamba wabena wabatenga waenda. Ministry of Health.
Right.
Used to follow us at Ridgeway campus to fill out employment letters. They would send the officers. They would camp at Ridgeway campus to help us fill out employment papers. So, na my fingerprints, but thing once
done.
Orientation into the civil service was done at Ridgeway campus. They would come, sit there and start explaining to us what the civil service is. What to expect.
Hey.
So my experience is different because we graduated at a time when government and the market was literally scraping the floor for doctors.
Right, right.
There were no doctors locally. We were producing them, yes, but they were not enough. So my experience was different.
Oh, wow.
I never went through what these kids are going through now.
Okay. And which hospital did you end up at?
So I ended up at UTH.
UTH.
Yes.
And how was it dealing with people? You're now in an environment that once brought you much trauma and pain.
Yes.
And now you're on the other side of the fence and you're healing and
that's
helping.
That's poetic justice. You see, that's
full circle.
Ironic, huh?
Full circle.
Full circle indeed. A place that brought me so much pain and horror.
Mm.
Became a place where I gave others hope.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Very, very ironic.
Mm.
I mean, of course, I went through all those motions and all those internal conflict. But I settled in quite well. The medical school did a very good job of settling you in, you know, because they introduced us to patients at a very earlier stage.
Right.
So they do it so well. The process was very well done at that time. And then the contact with lecturers was very good at that time because we were few as students. So the mentorship was good. The psychological, you know, management of the students was good.
Right.
It's not like now where you have a bunch of students surrounding one lecturer.
Correct.
During a right round. No, for us, it would be like two of you in a
But that's very unit. Personalized.
It's very, very, you know, So for me, I think much credit goes to the teachers and the lecturers that, you know, raised us in that space. I mean, of course, there were issues there. You experience your first death of a patient. You lose a patient for the first time.
Yeah.
It's not a good feeling.
No.
But here's what is interesting. It never gets easier. I don't know how God designed people, huh?
Yeah.
Bro, patients can die on you so for so many years.
But it still hits.
Yeah. It hits you the same way.
Yeah.
Yeah. You never get used to it. Maybe the others would do, but I never got used to it.
Mm.
To this day, I don't get used to. It's not a nice feeling to lose a patient.
No.
Yeah.
I can only imagine.
Yeah.
And moving towards something that has become basically your mainstay, men's health.
Yes.
What drove that? Was it an experience with a couple of patients and the realization that people just don't know what they don't know?
Mm.
And with that said, how have you harnessed the use of social media for that?
Right. No, you see, having worked in the medical space for the duration that I have, you will notice that programs that relate to women are generally very well funded.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of buzz and activity around issues that relate to women.
Right.
Especially health-related issues.
Mm.
With men, you will struggle to find a well-funded program that targets men.
Mm.
Take cervical cancer, for example. I mean, of course, Zambia has a big problem with cervical cancer globally.
Indeed.
We are ranked number 3 in the world. It is the leading cause of death and hospitalization among women in Zambia and globally.
Mm.
So cervical cancer is a huge crisis for us.
Mm-hmm.
And so, of course, a lot of funding has gone in there.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
But with prostate cancer affects men just as badly.
Correct.
Prostate cancer is very common in black men.
Mm. Mm.
And it is the leading cause of death and hospital admission among black men globally. And in Zambia, if you go to the cancer disease hospital and you count the men who are admitted, they were receiving treatment, majority of them would be prostate cancer. Yes. Then I realized, you know what? Men also have a very bad health-seeking behavior.
Mm.
Yes.
Ukaona
mamu na abu rako hospital, and I used to see this a lot at UTH. When a man comes to the hospital, it is not because he has come by himself.
No.
Men get brought to the hospital. They don't,
done. We're
they don't go there.
But, incapable of going on his own. Where now the resistance has crumbled, so he has no say in the matter.
Yes, of course.
Sad.
So men, I noticed that compared to women, men came to the hospital very late.
Mm.
I never understood that.
Mm.
I don't know that it's a Zambian phenomenon or it's everywhere. I don't know. Then I realized that maybe this is an area that needs attention.
Right. Right.
These men. Maybe it's an issue of lack of information. Or maybe, and if there's information, maybe it's the way the information is packaged.
Hmm.
So that's when, you know, I decided to take it up and push the agenda. And right now, it's quite interesting to see that when it comes to prostate cancer screening, particularly this year, a lot of men have come forward.
Yes.
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 Just last week, we screened more than 100 men.
Finally.
Yes. Finally. The message has gotten through after 3 years of talking.
continuously. Debunking myths. and they will go with a narrative which is negative.
The other issue with men is that I also noticed that men would be struggling with matters of erectile dysfunction and things like that.
Mm.
And they don't want to come out.
No.
Okay. Why? It's because it was on a bwanji. You see. And you know the way men ask for help? I'm about that, you're grim guys.
Yes. Like it's always third person. Yeah. Like,
okay. Yeah. If you hear a guy say, grim guys, just
you say, okay. Yeah. So when did this start?
Just... And then there's also this thing where they'd be like, I know a guy.
Mm.
He also had a similar problem. He went and drank this green coffee. You also go and drink it.
Mm.
Or he went and drank power. You also go and drink it.
Mm.
But men don't realize that even if you and me had erectile dysfunction problems, correct, our causes could be different.
Totally different.
Your cause and my cause could be totally different. Mm. Here's an example. You know that one of the well-documented causes of erectile dysfunction is a nagging wife.
Really?
Yes, yes. Very well documented.
So the emotional damage caused by a nagging wife can...
Yes. So if your wife is giving you a tough time, you can't get an erection.
True.
You can't.
Mm.
And if you did, you can't sustain it.
Mm.
Now, if for you the problem is a nagging wife, and then you don't tell me that that's the issue, right? Mm. And then I tell you, in a Nama coffee.
Uh-uh.
And when I had the coffee, I had a...
Sorted.
Nakupasa naka coffee. Now you are in Dawam. But you are going back to an environment where you are being nagged.
Emotionally.
And then you come happened. Back to me and say, you were to coffee truck was to save it.
Useless stuff.
So the point we're trying to do with men is to say, look, you guys, just because your friend is struggling with the same thing, it doesn't mean it's the same thing for you.
True.
So come to the hospital, let's discuss it.
Mm.
So what we have done now, I don't know that I'm allowed to say this on your platform.
Go ahead. We're unfiltered.
At CarePic Specialist Clinic, which I run,
yes,
we've set up a men's clinic now.
Mm.
And this clinic is specifically targeting men.
Right.
Yes.
Right.
So it's a safe environment where men can come meet with a specialist and open up their issues.
Mm.
Just be open. And we are seeing that a lot of men are, you know,
right,
coming forward.
Right.
Remember that if you go to hospitals generally, there are very few spaces that are created specifically for men.
For men, correct.
And designed
correct.
For a man to come in and be comfortable and share his issues in a manner that, you know.
Right.
So that's how far we have gone. Social media. And social media presented an opportunity for me, albeit by accident, but it presented an opportunity to be able to reach people and reach a lot of people.
Right.
Social media is... you know how it is in Zambia. If you want to grow your social media page, there are several ways of doing it. One of the popular ones is being scandalous.
Exactly. Controversial.
Either I scandalize myself or I scandalize other people.
Exactly.
And my page will grow.
Right.
But for me, I decided from the very beginning, first of all, to define my audience.
Right.
I was very clear from the outset that my audience for social media is going to be non-medical people.
Right.
And so on my page, I am not addressing doctors, I'm not addressing nurses. Because I keep reminding people come to my page for that, because I get a lot of criticism from fellow health workers on social media.
Right.
Yes, I do.
Right.
Especially in the early stages. And I had to keep reminding them. But the reason I am writing this the way I have done it, I'm trying to target somebody who's never been to medical school.
That's it. For the layman.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. No, you are too simplistic. No, you are too this. No, that's not accurate. Yes.
But we want to understand it. We are not
the reason it is not sounding accurate is because of the language I have chosen to use in the words.
Correct.
Because because I'm using ordinary language, okay, we both know that I would have to use a Latin word for this thing to be very... you know,
exactly.
Solid.
And leave
I'm not writing for you.
No.
If I put a Latin word here that makes it very accurate, Uyusazamvera.
That's it. Over the bar.
They will not listen.
What's the point?
They will not get it. Don't even understand
it.
And this is my target audience. So I had to fight through that. And so we defined our audience.
Right.
Then we defined the methods we will be using. small short posts,
right?
Short write-ups and videos.
Mm.
And then the other thing we decided to do was to lace it with a bit of humor.
Yes.
So we stretch the truth a little bit without distorting it.
Right.
Uh-huh.
Right.
So now when my fellow professionals see that, they get angry.
Say, no.
So we stretch a little bit without breaking it.
Mm.
Yes. And we lace it with a bit of humor. Yeah. For example.
Yes.
I can very easily say when the baby is in the mother's womb is surrounded by amniotic fluid,
yes,
which helps protect the baby from shocks and things like that.
Right.
Because I've said amniotic fluid, after a few weeks or a few days, an ordinary person may not even remember that.
Forget what he said something about fluid.
Yes.
That's it.
But if I tell somebody that, and this is an actual post that we made on the page.
Right.
We posted and said, when you're in your mother's womb, you used to drink your own urine.
Come on. Like, wait, me? All of me.
This doctor is not okay.
But that's a conversation starter. Immediately, the person is going to think about it,
yes,
about stuff he's never thought about.
Yes. But you see, then if they go read further, they'll find that same amniotic fluid, when they were swallowing
recycling,
it was helping to develop their intestines.
Correct.
Without being able to swallow that fluid,
No, they wouldn't grow, wouldn't develop. And surprise, a lesson learned. No, never to forget. There's a worm tooth. No, it's impossible. The same way no one has ever forgotten watermelon.
Of course. Look, the issue of the watermelon, it's interesting that you've raised it, right? Watermelon has a lot of health benefits.
Right.
It has water, it has minerals, it has vitamins and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But it has a very interesting vitamin also that improves blood flow. And right, it's a natural aphrodisiac.
Right.
Okay. So I could have easily said, I eat watermelon because it has vitamins, it has water, it has all.
Boring.
But there's a specific vitamin or chemical that sits in that watermelon, especially the white part of the watermelon.
Yes.
That is extremely good for men.
Mm.
So I felt to myself, you know what? This is what we are going to promote about this fruit.
Right.
Yes. And people are eating the fruit.
Oh, they're eating it. It's the dessert of choice in many homes.
Mm-hmm.
Do you go to watermelon?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
You never used to eat fruit. And it's a common fact, yes, that in Zambia, men,
yes,
until recently, did not enjoy their fruit.
No.
Fruit was something you ate in hospital.
No. Right. But you see, what's interesting is that watermelon actually works.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm.
Those claims work. In fact, for mild erectile dysfunction,
right,
you can actually prescribe watermelon.
And it will do the trick.
It will work.
Yeah. Well, yeah, men have heard it. Clearly. Clearly. Because it's not uncommon to see them pulling off on, especially great growth road.
And also,
and stocking up.
If you eat watermelon with its seeds,
right,
it helps with this, the health of the prostate. It sort of like slows down the growth and
right, the right. So the enlargement.
Yeah.
Amazing. And all these benefits. But how did you stumble upon this? What sort of research?
It's there in literature.
Really?
Yeah. It's there. Somebody just needed to bring it to the public.
So people were just flipping those pages and not bothering with it.
Yeah. It's there. And then, of course, doctors are very conservative people.
Mm, mm.
We are trained to keep to ourselves.
Right.
So when someone like me comes out and sticks out like a sore thumb.
Too extroverted
for the norm. The profession is very conservative.
Yes.
In nature. So that's probably why.
Oh, my goodness. And you touched on creating a safe space at Care Peak, which is the specialist hospital that you run. And this was obviously born from your time in public hospital.
Yes.
Where you saw for yourself that a person would be hard-pressed to come out with the real,
yes,
gist of the conversation. And even wonder, okay, if I go and I'm seen going to this department, what will the, yes, next guy think immediately?
100%.
And so what's your advice to someone who's struggling right now and doesn't know where to go?
Yes.
To go and consult and just, yes, say, listen, I have this problem, but I need a safe space where I can speak about it.
Yes. One of the things I noticed when I worked in the public sector is that Hands down, the public sector has very, very good doctors.
Mm.
They have very strong teams, by the way, because in the public sector, they work in teams. Yeah. A team would have not less than 20 doctors. So if you're a patient and you're in the public sector, just know that you may be interacting with one doctor, but behind that doctor, there's like 19 others who are looking after you. And they meet, discuss your case and review your case.
Right.
The problem, though, with the public sector, from my experience, was the sheer numbers.
Right. Overwhelming numbers.
So a doctor has to see 60 patients per day on his own and, you know, 70 patients on his own.
Oof.
Especially during our time.
Right.
I don't know now with these level one hospitals that they have put. So what tended to happen was that a patient had no time to ask questions. And even if they did have time to ask questions, the doctor has no time to start explaining to you why. No. There's a long queue outside.
He's got 69 people waiting after you.
So I sit at the corner, I went, next. Next.
Out.
He's only human.
True. True.
And as he goes, as he or she goes towards lunch, yeah, my temper, man. So we decided, you know what? Let's create an environment where a man can come, sit there, and ask questions and bring out issues and discuss. Because we discovered that when a patient is empowered with information, because you as a doctor, the amount of time I have with you as a patient in my office is very small.
Right.
But if I can empower you with information, because for the majority of the time, you'll be by yourself, I won't be there. You'll be taking the drugs by yourself, I won't be there. So if I want to improve outcomes, it becomes very critical to educate you. So that even if I am not there, you can navigate your condition.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Usually what I advise patients is to say, don't Google your symptoms. I generally discourage that. But do Google your diagnosis.
Right.
So if I give you a diagnosis, go and read about it as much as possible. So that by the next visit, we can have a more informed conversation.
Right.
And
right.
a more informed patient gives you, you know, better outcomes.
Better. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So,
so we decided to create a space like that for men to allow men to come through
right.
and ask right. questions. Take right. your time. Don't be in a hurry. This is the private sector. Don't be in a hurry. We go through issues.
This one is your by time.
It's your time.
Right.
Yeah. So we do that deliberately.
Oh, well played. And so in fronting advocacy and pushing this agenda, has that led you to probably consider venturing into leadership roles in the medical space?
I was president of the Zambia Medical Association for 2 terms.
Right.
From the last time I handed over office, no other president has served 2 terms. And that was a long time ago. I was chief executive officer of the Health Professions Council.
Right.
That's the council that gives licenses to hospitals and doctors.
Yes.
And you basically regulate, you know, training, hospitals, practitioners, and all that. And I've held various leadership roles within the profession.
Right.
As I was coming up in the Resident Doctors Association and things like that.
Right.
I was consultant. I rose all the way to levels, to consultant level when I served in the public sector with UTH. I used to lead the team of doctors as well. I used to teach with UNSA. I was coordinator for the MBCHB program, year 5, for quite some time. So in public space, I think I have served my country.
Right, right.
Now I'm focused more on contributing privately.
Right.
And the stuff I'm doing on social media, what I'm doing with CarePick.
Right.
Yeah. If you're asking specifically, am I considering going into politics?
Maybe.
Probably not. Here's why I would be hard pressed to get into politics.
Right.
The people that follow my content
come
from both sides of the aisle.
Right.
So if I choose a side, I'll be alienating a whole group of people.
Right. Right.
And for the kind of work that I am doing on social media, it becomes very difficult for me to do that. So and I've always struggled. Am I interested in politics? Absolutely. I love politics. Okay. I enjoy politics.
Right.
Yes, of course.
Right.
Yes. but do I want to get into politics right now? with the kind of work I'm doing,
right?
Probably not, because I'll cut off a whole group of people.
Right.
Yes.
Right. Let's shift over to your personal life. Are you married, doctor?
Yes, very married. Aha. Like extremely
married. Yeah. Thanks for clearing that up, because that's a question we keep getting. Is he married?
No,
spoken for.
So I'm married. I'm married to Ushma Ben Patel.
Right.
She's also a doctor.
Hmm.
Zambian of Asian origin.
Right.
My wife works as a cardiac anesthesiologist.
Ah.
Her job is very weird.
Hmm.
That woman, her main job is to kill you so that the doctors can operate on your heart.
And then bring you back.
When they are done operating on your heart, she'll then resurrect you.
Hi.
Yes.
Not for the faint-hearted.
I am literally afraid of that woman. I live in fear in that house. You want to tell me what
I'm
saying? I'm going to tell you what
I'm saying. You're well married. It explains why you qualify how married you are. Yeah, do not spurn that woman.
So between us, we have four daughters.
Right. Ah, fantastic. And what virtue, with regards to love and relationships, would you pass on to your kids?
And I'm saying this with hindsight, right?
Hmm.
I think the biggest thing, way beyond the fact that you love somebody, is patience.
Right.
I think we need to be patient with each other. There's something that I have come to learn that you don't hear so much in conversations around people who are married and things like that. In the curriculum for marriage counseling,
right,
they should include the fact that people change as you grow.
Mm.
I have changed and I'm still changing.
Right.
I am not the same person she met.
Mm.
Yeah. She's also changing. She's not the same person I met.
Mm.
So just being patient with each other, I think for me, that's a big one.
Right.
Yeah. Because it's not enough that you love somebody.
Mm.
You need to be patient with somebody.
Mm.
The other thing that I have learned is the fact that if you have observed, you're married, my good sir.
Yes, I am. Very married.
If you look at your own experience with marriage, you will notice that in the first few years of marriage, you were both very excited.
True.
You know, always wanting to be in each other's presence and things like that.
Mm.
But marriage gets you to there's another phase where it gets to where your partner just begins to irritate you.
Mm.
Yes. Either by the way they are chewing, suddenly you're paying attention how they're chewing. Why is it that the way I'm now noticing how she is chewing?
Mm.
Are you telling me that all along, stands on?
Where was this?
Yes.
Yes.
Suddenly the way she's chewing is irritating you.
Hmm.
So marriage does get to that phase where you begin to feel like unaluvianya. It does, and everybody goes through that. But they don't tell you.
Right.
And for most couples that end up living, that's when they leave. But nobody tells that's just a phase. It passes.
It passes. Yes. Yeah. Yes.
And once you cross that phase,
the
rest of the marriage is nice.
You there's understanding.
Because at that point now, you've learned each other's weaknesses.
Right.
You've learned things you don't like. You've now learned the things you don't like.
Be as real as you can be.
Yeah. Mm. And now you are comfortable. You've settled.
Right.
So, if you ask me what one thing I have learned that I can pass on is forbearance. Yes. Be patient with each other.
Yeah.
You're human beings at the end of the day.
I hear you.
You're a human being. I'm a human being. And that is why this issue of 50-50 in marriage involves both a child. The issue is that you should care about the marriage independent of what I'm doing in the marriage.
Right.
And I should care about the marriage independent of what you're doing as a partner.
Mm.
Yes.
Mm.
Do I care about the marriage that much?
Yes.
And do you care about the marriage that much?
Then you're all fully invested.
Now, that realization comes after that phase where you feel like unaruf.
Yes.
Once you cross that phase, Those are the people you admire a lot. Ah, baja. No, go and ask them. They'll tell you. There were times they felt like giving up.
Navigated some serious storms.
But they never did.
Right.
And that's something that if I was to teach my kids is to say, look, there's this phase. I mean, of course, notwithstanding abuse. I mean, I'm not one for physical abuse. No. I mean, and I'm not saying, no, stay in a marriage where you're being beaten. Why?
No.
So I'm not talking about that level. I'm talking about these standard issues. Yeah. And they need to add that in the curriculum for marriage counseling. That there's that cafe is
that
phase.
Yeah. Yeah.
But emphasize the fact that it's just a phase.
True. It's turbulence. It's hitting turbulence in a flight and jumping out.
If I was to teach my child about marriage, that's one of the things I would deliberately remember to mention.
And what is your parenting style?
Me, I'm hands-on.
Okay.
Yes. So because I'm a very busy person, right?
Right.
We run our own business. So, and because I know I'm extremely busy, a day like this one, Saturday, belongs to the girls.
Right.
Yeah. As you can see, today I came with one.
Yes.
The other three there with the mother. Straight from here.
Yeah, reconvening.
I would need her permission for me to go anywhere else because Saturday
is the day that daddy is with his girls. Yes. Right.
And then I also deliberately drop my kids at school myself and I do my best to also pick them up. Why?
Right.
Because you want to be present.
True.
You want to make time. You want to, because the time you have with your kids is also very limited. The moment these chaps go to university, that's it. If you never spend time with them, you will never catch up.
No, it's done. It's done.
It's gone. I end them. You'll never catch up with them.
No, they'll never be fully at your disposal.
So I'm very deliberate in making time with them and for them as much as for the duration that they are under my roof.
Right.
Because I know that duration is very short.
Yeah.
The moment these chaps say they're going to university,
departure lounge.
I never spent time with them, I will never get that chance.
You can't make it up then.
Because they'll meet other strangers. They'll start bringing chaps I don't even like to my house. Meet this chap. Dad, meet this guy. I'm not sure if I even like the chap.
It's
what I mean.
It's the reality of life.
It's what I mean. So I'm very deliberate when it comes to just making sure that I'm making the time. So I'm really hands-on with them.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
I'm very present.
Right.
In their lives.
You mentioned that your mom was a stickler for going to church.
Very.
In fact, your dad was a stickler for church, if I heard you. Yes. So both parents ensured there was this drive to ensure that you must go to church, come rain or shine. Is that your position with your kids as well?
Yes, they must go to church. Yes, they go to church.
No debate.
They have to. They go.
I love that.
Even if I may not go, but they go.
Okay. Yeah. And on the same front, the discipline of school. For you, school is zero compromise. Have you also adopted that?
It's the same.
You will go to school.
Mm-hmm.
I hear
you. It's the same. They know that.
Dr. Aaron Jajati, thank you so much for taking so much of your time out of a very busy schedule to come and talk to us and give us a glimpse into aspects of your life that are not common knowledge.
Right.
Keep up the excellent work. We love the fact that have an environment where they can speak.
Right.
They know, even as we laugh and joke and comment, there's a lesson that's being gleaned and captured.
Right.
Thank you so much for all the work you're doing. And here's to more wins.
Thank you. And thanks for having me, bro.
Always a pleasure.
Yet another epic episode of Nkwazi Unfiltered. We've been chatting with Dr. Aaron Mjajati, and he's shown us aspects of his life that have been filtered, but today they were completely unfiltered. We understand what drives him. We've got context to why he does what he does. And we are inspired, as always. Be sure to catch Nkwazi Unfiltered wherever you catch our podcasts and don't miss a single episode. You just never know who'll be sitting in the hot seat next time round. My name is Kamisa Chikula. Catch you on the next one.